I would like to ask for your attention for a few considerations around practice. It seems one of the laws that when something becomes more popular, something that was maybe specific, even technical, something that has specialist teachings, literature, terminology, when something like that becomes popular, it seems to be strangely more difficult to talk about it. I think we're at the stage when mindfulness is just in this situation. It's not so easy to talk about it anymore. Other things have gone through that process. The word yoga, for example, or the word meditation. There was a time it was very clear what meditation was. Yeah, if you were a Benedictine, then it was fairly clear what meditation was. It was part of your daily schedule. It was the reflective bit in between the reading and the contemplative exercises. If you were a Buddhist, although you didn't know the meditation, there were a couple of things that we now call meditation that were also fairly clear. They were part of a monastic contemplative tradition. But then the centuries elapsed, the cultures changed, and yoga suddenly came to the West, and from being an attempt to unify the mind and yoke the individual experience and the universal experience together, yoga became something more associated with health, wellness, lifestyle. Meditation sometimes becomes, you know, the considerations of your parish priest in his Sunday morning speeches. And it somehow is not so easy anymore to speak about yoga or meditation. Now, that just seems to be the nature of things. When something becomes more familiar, when it becomes general parlance, it seems to be more tricky to not lose the precision. So, one of the challenges when we try to deepen our mindfulness is what is it actually we're trying to deepen? What is it actually? It's very challenging to speak about the function of mind that is so pervasive, that is so ubiquitous, that is so normal. Yeah? You weren't here if you weren't mindful, just to be clear about this. If you have no mindfulness at all, it's not that you're having stress in your life or emotional problems. If you're having no mindfulness at all, then you have mental problems. Yeah? And people in white shirts give you bad numbers. So we all have mindfulness, but it's not so easy to identify what that actually is. Quite a challenge. In Buddhist psychology, we speak of a distinction between attention, which is something you have all the time. Every moment of your experience has an element of attention. And we speak of mindfulness, which is not something you necessarily have all the time. It is a bit more lofty. Now, where the difference exactly is between manasikara and between sati is a matter of debate. Not even the Buddhists were really in agreement about this. Differing traditions have come to different opinions about this. But it's clear that there is a distinction. So, if we look at attention, then this is something that has two parts. Basically, one part has to do with that it can be called upon. Any strong stimulus will produce a response of attention in me. This is how we survive, yeah? If the saber-toothed tiger jumps in here, then you have the capacity to somehow respond to that event. It's unlikely, given the prevalence of saber-toothed tigers have somewhat decreased, but something in us would know how to cope with this. Some of us would get eaten, some of us would get away. And you don't need to think. In fact, nature has thought it wise to not rely on discursive processes for such decisions. If you have things on the scale of saber-toothed tigers in your life happening, generally they are not addressed by your cognitive discursive mind. It's too slow and it's too inaccurate to really be reliable. We wouldn't have survived if we had to rely on our perceptual processes to get by. So attention has the involuntary part of our attention is geared for things that arise that are new, that are sudden, that are surprising, that are intense. So a part of our attention just goes to whatever happens suddenly, unpredictably, that has some intensity in our sense realm, or that has some delight. Yeah. So there's part of our system that is geared to things that appear and they get our attention. This is quite easy to see. Now, if we leave our attention to that part alone, then we will be continually in a sort of state of vigilance where the things are happening. Things are pleasant, then we go to them because they're pleasant. Things are dangerous, then we go to them because they're dangerous. That's a very necessary function of mind. This is one aspect of attention. You can train that aspect a little bit. You can shorten your reaction time, say. You know, you can train with saber-toothed tigers. They come in and you respond quickly or a bit more slowly. But on the whole, this type of attention is not very good for sustaining things. It's not very good for insight things. It's not very good for happiness things. It's very good for crisis, emergencies, saber-toothed tigers. Buddhist teaching has favored the training and the emphasis on practice on another type of attention, and this attention psychology would call, I think, deliberate attention, or voluntary, I think. Forgot what it is in English exactly, but you will probably recognize it. It's something to do with my choice where my attention goes, because that's the other side of attention. We're not just victims of sensory stimulation. We can actually make choices. We can say, well, this is something I'm going to dedicate some of my attention to. Now, that choice is very, very powerful. If we make that choice consciously, then there is a cumulative effect of that power. If we do not make that choice consciously, then what will win is generally conditioning. It's generally the seeking aspect of our mind, that part which kind of scans and looks, well, what could I get here? You know, is there somebody interesting to talk to? Are there some cookies being passed around? Where would be nice to sit? Who wears something nice? Can I read, eat, taste, touch, visit something? Yeah, there's a sort of continual scanning faculty in my mind that looks, where is the promise for gratification? If I don't choose where my attention goes, this part is likely to win. Buddhist psychology makes a few distinctions. If you're more kind of interested in gratification, then this is the part which you will do. If you're more kind of struggling with anxieties, then you will kind of, rather than look for the nice bits, you will look for the dangerous bits. You know, what could be dangerous right now here? You know, okay, I'll sit closer to the exit. I make sure that the big guys are sitting over there. I make sure I have the back to the wall, so nothing goes behind me. Yeah? You have another agenda. The agenda is not pleasure. The agenda is risk. If you're more of a, what Buddhist psychology calls, hateful temperament, then you're geared for trouble. Yeah? You're looking, what's not okay here? It's drafty in here, isn't it? They could have done a bit better job on the wall decoration. Why do they play football when I want to do meditation? Can't they stop? doing this football business when I do meditation. You know, I've got to cultivate my precious attention and they're going to play football right across it. You know? So, or his glasses are funny. You know, he's got a real hunch, hasn't he? Or is he asleep? I wonder. You know. So if you're in a, if you're more kind of a aversive, hateful disposition, then you will probably focus in on things that are not okay, on things that are not good, on things that give you reason to be vexed, to be annoyed, to be displeased. So some of us go in and just look for the nice bits. Yeah? These are called the greed. This is the greed character. Some of them go for the anxiety bit. You know, this, some of us go in for getting annoyed, never being content. And then we have a few other characters. Confusion. You know, am I sitting in the right place? I wonder what they think about me. I wonder whether it shows that I have a hip ailment, or oh, can I open the button of my trousers here? Is this okay? You know, it's tight. But will they mind? You know, will I be frowned upon? Am I doing it right? You know, this is more the confusion type. So if you get this kind of messages, you will be probably more of a confused disposition. Now, you know, the point is not that we identify with these dispositions, but they tell us something about our conditioning. They tell us something about how we look into the world. In Buddhist teachings, they're not verdict. They're not DSM-4 diagnoses. You know, the great thing about Buddhist teaching is it gives us a horizon to grow. It says just because you have this pattern running doesn't mean that you are one of those. It just means you have to take responsibility for this pattern. If this pattern doesn't make you happy, or if it doesn't allow that you become quiet, or if it induces you to have a burnout, then you may consider changing that pattern. And since the capacity to change that pattern is very much in your reach, let's find out how to do this. Yeah? So it's quite pragmatic. There is some even behavioral, psychological pragmatism in early Buddhist teaching in particular. The language is not psychological. You know, much of the contemplative traditions deal with psychological dimension of our experience without having a psychological language. So it's no wonder that we often, when we speak about meditation, we refer to the processes in our own inner life in psychological terms. In the Buddha's day, these terminology was slightly different. Although you find a remarkable Buddhist epistemology going, people would think of themselves differently than they do now. So what can we learn? We can learn one of the first tasks if we are engaged in trying to train our capacity to attend is twofold. It's finding out what our attention already does, because that is very revelatory. Where does my attention habitually go? This is a very useful thing to know. The next one is finding out whether this is actually generating happiness in my life. Yeah. If it does not generate happiness, let's find out what we could do better to find happiness. Unless you're willing to think about these things, you'll just make out of meditation practice yet another thing you should do more of, and you're feeling bad about not being good at it, and you think, you know, maybe another couple of books read would help you, or if only you didn't have back pain you would do more of it and then it would be really good in your life. You know, unless you're willing to think what's already happening with my attention, does what is happening actually provide happiness? Does it provide contentment? Does it provide, is it effective? And what could I do to change that? Unless we're willing to think about these things, we're just going to turn meditation practice in yet another self-improvement project that we're not good enough at, that we don't do enough of, that we have written on our yellow labels. that we secretly suspect we have a congenital deformity that stops us from doing. They all look quiet and angelic, and I'm the only one sitting here worrying about Monday morning. So I would like to think with you a little bit about this. Before we do specific attention exercises, I'd like to think of you. How do you know that you are mindful? How do you know that? This is a real question. I mean it. I would like to hear how you know that you are mindful, when you are mindful. What are your suggestions? I'm listening.
I think that you notice what comes up. You have an immediacy with thoughts, feelings, emotions.
Okay, there is a reflective instance which knows this takes place now. Yeah? Okay. Other voices, thank you.
When you realize that you haven't been focusing on the breathing, you haven't been paying attention to the breathing.
Okay.
For a period of time.
So you have a sort of retrospective awareness that you were not present with the chosen task.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you are aware that you were not.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And the fact that you are aware now that you were not is mindfulness. Is that it?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Other voices.
I suppose the opposite of that is noticing something in the first moment that it's arising.
Okay.
A thought about to arrive, or a thought just at the very turning point.
So being right there when it begins.
Just, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
My mind's gone to that direction again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
There's a quality of, not fuzziness, but more clear clarity.
Mm-hmm. In what you think, or what you feel, or what you hear? Or
I think it's a physical sense of...
Uh-huh. A physical sense.
A physical sense of not blurredness.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
On a similar line, physical sense of openness. I mean, sometimes you feel, okay, I'm totally here, you feel openness to the kind of body extending beyond what I am, right? Sort of.
So you're present and you're open.
Open, yes.
Okay.
For me, it's a real physical sense of feeling like I'm looking from inside of my body rather than outside of my body, like where my vision is coming from.
Uh-huh. So you're using an ocular metaphor, huh? And you're saying you're looking from inside your body.
Yeah, I know it sounds strange, but...
No.
It's like I can start over there and then all of a sudden switch to...
What would be the alternative? Where would you look from if you were not inside from your body?
Externally.
Okay, so you would be somewhere out there looking down or looking in. Okay. So, you're describing that your field of vision starts from an embodied point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Other ways, how you know that you're mindful.
I find it easier to know when I'm not mindful.
Okay.
I find the question of how do I know that I'm mindful, I don't come against anything. It's like when I know that I'm not mindful, like I go back and check the tap.
Okay.
I've forgotten completely that I've actually done it properly.
Mm-hmm. So mindful is when you actually don't know it. Is that what you're saying?
I would imagine so. I can't find an answer to this question that you just asked. How do I know when I'm being mindful?
Uh-huh.
But I know when I haven't been mindful.
Uh-huh. Do you also know when you're not mindful, not just when you have been not mindful, but do you also know when you're not mindful?
I love to think about that.
Yeah, please.
For me, it seems to be linked with pace.
Pace.
Yes, the more I slow down, the more mindful I notice I am, and the other way around.
Slow down, you mean your breath, your thinking pattern, your heart rate?
The less I rush around, the slower my movements are, the more mindful I become. And the more mindful I become, the more slower I go as well.
So when you sense the slowing down,
yes.
You know that you're going towards mindfulness. Or that this is mindfulness.
Yes.
Yeah. Others, please.
With regard to emotions, when I'm aware that I'm having the emotion rather than it's having me, I'm actually aware that this is, say, very painful, but I'm aware that I'm not caught up solely in the pain.
Yeah. So when you're basically conscious that something takes place rather than sits in your neck and rides you or drives you. Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Yeah, there's something for me about that being aware of my experience, but something as well of kind of filling my attention, like it being really there and full of that, whatever it is, whether it's emotion or feeling or body, and very sort of present as well, present moment. But there is a bit of kind of having to be aware of that rather than because like there's another thing of kind of being lost in something, and that's not kind of quite mindful because it's not
that being there. Has that to do with intensity? I mean, it's kind of as if you're in a color movie rather than in a black and white movie, or it's clear rather than hazy, or
more kind of more full, like the color movie.
Thank you. Other voices, please.
When everything seems fresh and alive, and one moment follows another, and each new moment seems very new.
Fresh and alive, every moment seems very new. Well, the rest of you are not mindful, okay? Please.
For me, when I notice that I'm mindful, there's something more of a curiosity and less judgment whether I like something or not. It's irrelevant, or it sort of fades away.
Curiosity.
Yeah, curiosity, and sort of feeling something that is. One example is sort of being out in the rain, which I used to hate, and then saw something change when I was more aware of what's actually happening, and I felt more the energy of the rain and so my attitude towards an experience changes.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, please.
It's probably something similar with the joking that I said. When I'm not awake or not mindful, it's more cognitive, daydreaming, lack of presence. But when I'm mindful, there is a sort of being present and experiencing that.
What notices that you're daydreaming or fuzzy or not there? What notices that?
How do I notice or how do you feel?
Yeah, what quality is
detached from reality. Like sort of I'm in my own little world. In a coffin room, it's just a good thing because I don't think it's bad to sometimes feel pleasurable, but it's not having that freshness.
Well, thank you.
I noticed that my sort of discursiveness. Reuses a lot, and my way of apprehending seems to change when I've got some moments of mindfulness. That is, it seems things come to me more than me going towards them.
Okay.
And I've got an openness to, and there's more intuitiveness. I see things through images.
So you're telling me that you notice that the discursive amount of information seems to recede, and that you're less apprehending.
No, that's my way of apprehending, of relating to reality, seem to have a space in which I don't go towards it, but something comes inside towards me.
Yeah. So you're more receptive. Yeah. Well, thank you.
For decades, I've had a problem with this term mindfulness in English.
Mm. So you object to the term in general?
Yeah, and experientially, not conceptually. I mean, as a consequence of what I experience, I was influenced by the fact that I cannot possibly be my mind.
No, that's...
I haven't... And I'm very, very surprised that for some decades I haven't really considered the mind inside a body, which is the general assumption and, you know, a very powerful one.
I wouldn't necessarily go along with that. I don't think this is the purpose of the term mindfulness. You know, we're speaking of a mind faulty.
The problem started for me decades ago when I noticed that sometimes the word chitta would be translated as mind,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes as heart. Mm-hmm. When it, in
yep.
the European languages, they're not really interchangeable these days.
How do you know you're mindful? Huh? I'm interested in that part. How do you know you're mindful? I know we could go down that track and I could tell you lots about
chitta
and mindfulness and the history of both the Buddhist terminology.
I can't be sure for these very reasons whether I'm being mindful, and I don't really think I want to be mindful.
But you're doing this for a few years now, isn't it? You're doing this for a few years. You're doing this for a few years, this meditation business, isn't it?
And
you're getting something there. I'm sure you have a way of knowing that this is working or this is not working.
Yeah,
How do you know that?
I would characterize it as a feeling of aliveness.
Okay. Now we're talking.
Which has the... I'm aware of its characteristics of constantly changing... being unsatisfactory as a consequence of that, and lacking in any fixed identity.
Well,
so
what do you feel? What do you feel when you speak of aliveness? Is this more color, or is this more fertile thinking, or is this more body sensation, or have things more relief and depth? Or when you say aliveness, what is this actually as a empirical quality?
Well, awareness that's synthesized ideally across all six sense tools.
Okay.
If awareness is there, then it's not just a question of being happy and upbeat.
Yep.
Because...
But can you do that? Can you actually know whether that synthesis takes place, better or worse? Can you?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the bit I was interested in. The other bit we need another time, because there's a few alleys we could go down there. But so, you sense that the synthesis of your sensory functioning leaving you with a deeper sense of aliveness, and that you rate as mindfulness.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't raise my mind, because in fact, it's when I'm jumping about dancing, that's when it is most effortlessly joyful, and really my intentionality isn't that really. I'm not consciously. I'm not mindfully connected to it.
Okay.
and I've, you know, the fact I'm talking about is that I'm slightly uneasy about the fact that this, you know, seems to be maybe out of sync with the dominant sort of European consensus.
I don't think there is a consensus, to be honest with you.
No, but
I wish there was.
Western Buddhists, there's a kind of consensus. The fact that they use the word mindfulness, which...
They don't. They're not even about in a consensus about that. Mm-hmm. They're not in a consensus, I can assure you.
Why the emphasis upon mindfulness, then? That
it has historically grown, but there is no such consensus, not even amongst Buddhists, let alone amongst Buddhists and psychologists. Not even about the value of the word mindfulness. In fact, that's why we need to speak about experiences rather than about terms. Yeah. Thank you. Good. Our last one.
Can I turn it into a question, out of ignorance, really? I come from a psychoanalytic background, so for me, mindfulness would be that there is an impulse inside or outside, and I have a propensity to react in a particular way, or sometimes we call it counter-transference, or the other patient does, and I step back and do not respond to the impulse, internal or external.
Yeah, then you
and
would call
mindfulness for me would be trying to understand why I'm feeling that way and what it is about. Now,
I understand, but this is not it.
Is that you don't try to understand it?
Well, we do, but this is not the purpose of the term mindfulness. We're speaking of a particular function of mind that has various aspects. One of them is attentional focus. One of them is a certain panoramic dexterity. One of them is... keenness of interest and orientation. One of them is certain stability, an explorative edge, and so forth. Yeah. So this is a technical term referring to a function of mind rather than a concept. And some people here practice that for a while. So I wanted to know from them whether they have ways and how they know whether this function of mind is present or has a certain strength or not. Well, good, you see, it's not quite easy, yeah? If I listen to your descriptions, they are quite colourful. And I can, I can acknowledge most of what I heard I would rate to be indicative of some form of mindfulness, but you're also conscious that none of you has said the same thing, isn't it? So it's necessary that we think about this, not just that we do it, because that we think about what it actually is, what we're trying to do, and how we know when it's happening. Buddhist teachings make three facets close friends. One facet is the capacity to actually associate with a process, an object, or a situation. The other facet, always mentioned together with mindfulness, is a quality of keenness or eagerness. Yeah. If you wanted to be neutral, you could call it intentional, but actually it's more than intentional. It is an active form of interest, a willingness to, with some eagerness, to engage. So many meditators wish their mindfulness to be a technique by which they can minimize painful things, going someplace where they cannot be hurt. That is understandable, that is perfectly valid if we have plenty of pain in our lives and we wish to have a strategy to minimize pain or even to minimize anxiety. In terms of evolutionary psychology, the things that help us to modulate our fears, our anxieties, are the things that we find most powerfully formative. What helps us to modulate fear states is, in terms of learning, is some of the most motivating stuff. So it's quite normal that we would wish for something that helps us to dissociate from a painful experience. But that is not mindfulness, to be honest with you. Mindfulness is not a technique for you to go away from the things that hurt. Mindfulness, contrary, is the opposite. It's something that helps you be more here. Yeah? It's not a dissociative strategy which allows you to go someplace where it doesn't hurt, where you can sit behind your candle or go into a place where it's peaceful and all the hurt and all the challenges and all the complexities fall away. I understand that this would be nice if we could do that, but that's not what mindfulness is about. Mindfulness is something that helps us to be more here. So being more here has to do with that kind of interest coming in, something that wants to engage, that uses intention. The third one is a function that is called sampajano in the Pali term, and it means it's referencing. It references, it clearly comprehends what actually takes place. So there's something that knows what takes place. So mindfulness is not a self-forgetfulness in a process. It's not just a flow experience or, you know, child's play, completely bereft of any reference to place, danger, duty, and so forth. So I'd like to give you a few images in which mindfulness speaks to us. A practical suggestion, the people who need to prepare food or who will prepare food, I do not know who these people are. Yeah? This is probably the moment you should take a break and go, please.
Can we catch up with
that?
In fact, I just decided that we'll do that in the early afternoon.
Oh, brilliant.
And so you will not miss out on this. Okay. Yeah. And for the others, I would like to give some walking instructions. I'll give you the images after we come back. And we will come back at 1:45. Okay? So we'll do half an hour walking meditation till 12:30. Then we'll have 1.25 hours for the meal. And we'll continue at 1:45 after that. I hope that Gary, would you convey it to them? Because they probably haven't heard it.
They won't be missing it. So,
but they will come back.
You're going to go into walking.
Yeah, right now.
So they won't have missed anything. I'm just trying to think if there's anything. Can I just make one announcement?
Yeah.
Just that if you're going to be, the bell will ring during the walking practice. The bell will ring, and that will, and then it'll be time to go into the canteen. To have a meal, but again, if you could wait until the bell, because it tends to get in the way. The second thing, as well, just get all the answers. The second thing is if you're going to be doing the washing up or clearing the tables, and if you have a job, feel free to go to the head of the queue. And probably with these numbers, it won't make a great deal of difference. But it is fine. It's not impolite, but you might want to just bow to indicate that you're there because you're doing a job. So it's not being rude. And the third thing is, if you haven't registered, we'll open registration up at about 1:25, so about 20 minutes before we start the afternoon session. So just if you could just come to the table just to give us your name.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
The areas to walk are the usual ones, Gary. The whole area can be used.
Yeah. I think I'm pretty sure the whole field is fine.
Okay.
I don't think there are any off limits, and it might be slightly wet from the rain, but I don't think there should be any problem otherwise.
Okay. Take a stretch. Define a clear beginning and an end of that stretch. Then you walk up and down. You walk down slowly. And the primary area of attention is the touch sensations in your feet. You're focusing on the change in the touch sensation of your feet. Please walk slowly. And before you walk, stand still, scan through your body for a moment, take stock of your posture, take stock of sensations, and then you walk. And if you walk very slow, and you will be able to leave one foot on the ground and move. Yeah? You roll, put the weight on the second foot. If you're walking a little faster, you'll probably need to focus on one foot. If you're very slow, you can just use the focus on both of your feet. Depending on the speed you choose, you will probably, when you walk a little faster, there's too much happening. Yeah, and one foot will come off while the next foot is actually taking the weight. So you will, in that, you will probably need to decide which foot you're going to focus on. If you're doing this, decide. If you're walking slower, then you will be able to actually have less activity, and both feet will still be on the ground when the front foot is taking the weight. So it is probably possible to stay with your awareness in both feet. Find out what actually is possible for yourself.